Broadcasting from Youngstown, Ohio, this is the MV Red Podcast, the show where we talk about news and politics impacting the Mahoning Valley, the state of Ohio, and the USA. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, find us on your favorite podcast streaming app or visit our website, www.mvred.com. If you want to share your opinion with us, please email info@mvred.com, as we would love to hear from you. Now, let's get things started. Here are your hosts, Michael Metzinger and Dane Davis.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to episode 21 of the MV Red Podcast. I'm Michael Metzinger. Joining me is my co-host, Dane Davis, and we're thrilled this evening to be joined by Ryan Gruduski. So we have a lot to talk about, but we really want to focus in throughout the evening on a race that doesn't seem to be getting a lot of attention at the national level, and it's the race for the Ohio 13th congressional seat between longtime incumbent Congressman Tim Ryan and Republican challenger Christina Hagan. But before we get into that, Ryan, do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us about your website, your newsletter, as well as your book.
Sure. So I'm Ryan Gruduski. I'm a writer and a political consultant, and I have a book that came out in July called They're Not Listening, How the Elites Created the National Populist Revolution, about the rise of national populism on a global scale. I have a weekly newsletter on national populism to try to kind of break down the news of the week on a global level, but on issues that national populists care about. And I have a website, RyanGruduski.com, or on Twitter at Ryan Gruduski, where I hope some of you guys saw this podcast link and started watching it.
So I am, first of all, super excited to have you on, and thank you. It's an honor because you're a big name, and we're just two random guys in Northeast Ohio.
I'm not that big of a name, but okay.
Oh, I think so. In the Davis household, you are. And okay. So thank you very much. And my first question, and I'm going to launch right in because I'm super pumped. I have been following your Twitter feed for, I would say, every day of my life for the past 3-4 years. I don't have a Twitter account, Brian. I'm a bit of a boomer. So what I do is the accounts I follow often, I just type in the names. So if I hit an R right on the tab, Ryan Gruduski comes up, and I click on that. And then I click from you, and I'll click on like the Columbia Bugle, right? Or Ann Coulter, or that. And my question to you is, how did I start following you? Because it's been like every day I read your feed. It's the essential Twitter feed for populist issues. But like, how did I start? I don't know. Like, it became part of my life, and I don't know where it began. I don't know where you began. So
I don't know where you started following me either. I guess I started getting a lot more traction and followers in the last like 2 years, especially. I've worked on politics for about 15 years. So in 2015, I was working on campaigns, and I said to myself, I was probably 27 at the time, 28. I was making a good living, and I was just done with working on the campaign life. Is a grueling life, and it's really hard after a certain age. And I just wanted to be, one area. My grandparents were kind of ill at the time, so I wanted to be closer to them. So I said, I'll be a writer, and I got a job at a website called Red Alert Politics, which was a subsidiary of the Washington Examiner. And it kind of blew up, and I was the sole Trump supporter at the entire Media DC, which is the conglomerate. They owned, at the time, they owned the Weekly Standard. I was the only vocal Trump supporter. So that kind of gave me a little traction. And then I started writing about politics primarily because I realized most people who wrote about it had never actually worked the campaign trail and had very little understanding of what was ever going on. So that was, I think, how I was able to make kind of a little niche for myself, because I'd experienced things from a certain perspective that most writers about politics really hadn't. And I don't know how you started following me. You were probably up late one night just going through the wormhole that is the internet.
I think so. So I was a big fan of, there's a pundit out there named Ala Pundit, who got started with Hot Air, which is a big conservative.
Yeah, I know who that is, Ala Pundit. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I think at the time it was during the 15 and 16 primaries, If you were a conservative and you followed the cast of characters of conservative names, there were not many Trump supporters. Hot Air was almost completely against him. The National Review, all of their writers were against him. The Weekly Standard, unsurprisingly, were against Trump. So yeah, I think your
workers.
And I think your name went, and I think, you know, you were one of the guys that was a lone Trump supporter. And so I think I just started rating you just because, hey, you know, I wanted an alternate perspective. And one really great thing about your Twitter feed, which I encourage people to subscribe to or to follow, at Ryan Jurdusky. I can't say that right. I'm so sorry.
Gurdusky.
Is that you've got a lot of news. You've got really good analysis and you're drama free. Like sometimes you follow these Twitter accounts and it's like there's so many like insider battles. But you've got, I think, a pretty fresh take on things. It's a unique perspective, and it seems pretty focused.
I lose my mind very rarely. I try really hard not to punch down to people. Well, about 2 years ago, I just blocked any comments from people that I don't follow. So I don't read the comments like 90% of the time. It's very rare that I'll actually read a comment. So I don't really ever pay attention when somebody is like saying something. And there's like a lot of people on the left that I really respect and that I am interested in their opinion. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to sit there and say, oh, look at my hot take about Maggie Haberman or somebody. And then she never speaks to me ever, or not doesn't speak. She doesn't speak to me now, but I just ruined that relationship. It just doesn't serve its purpose. It's not, you know, owning the libs or owning the never Trumpers or whatever. I mean, it's fun to shit on Bill Kristol, but why use my platform to spread his bullshit? Like, I just don't find that to be, I do it sometimes because it is fun, but it's not usually worth it. And I try hard not to punch down. There's some YouTuber who was like attacking me. I have no idea what his name is, but like, here's my thing. If you really have that big of a problem with me, I'm not that hard to sit there and find. I go to events, I go meet people, I kind of post where I'm going to book signing or something like that. Come say it to my face. Don't sit there and I'll be a keyboard warrior. That's bullshit. And that really just pisses me off. So it's very rare that I sit there and want to do an online fight with somebody. Because it's stupid. Anyone's tough when they're behind a keyboard.
And I think that's a crucial point, right? So somebody that just wants like a good news feed of analysis and news, and it's like kind of not your typical conservative take, I would highly recommend that they follow you. And one final question before I turn over to Michael, because I'll just keep going because I get so excited. But you describe yourself as a national populist, right? I want to quote the terminology national populist. And, you know, Americans kind of, we fall within, you know, conservative on one side or liberal on the other. Those are the words that we use. And we've just now heard the word socialist, right? Europe was familiar with it for 150 years, but we're just now starting to throw that term. What is a national populist? How is that different from just a conservative? And how did you kind of reach that point?
Well, you know, I guess like in my mid to late 20s, when I started talking about politics as a whole, I kind of bounced between ideology or what I believed in. And nothing really fit the bill. I always was fans of people like Ron Paul or Pat Buchanan or Russell Kirk. I read Ann Coulter, who's like a friend of mine. I get to say now I know Pat Buchanan pretty well. But those people I was really big fans of and interested in their opinions. But I'd always kind of have an issue with something or the other. And I kind of was trying to find a niche that I believed in. And so much of what ideology is and political religion is they care more about the mechanisms to arrive at how they would solve a problem than solving the problem themselves. So for a Vox.com reader, you have to figure out how to solve a problem through the efforts of the government, through like the government being the main primary role to sit there and solve any social ill. Or if you're a libertarian, it's the free market. I cared more about, okay, how do we solve the problem? You know, I do believe in some things that we would consider like, you know, left wing. Like I'm a very big supporter of zoning laws. I'm a big gun rights advocate, and I'm a big, you know, I'm pro-life, I'm Catholic. I'm really big on, you know, on reducing legal immigration and ending illegal immigration. It's my kind of my niche issue. But I love Glenn Greenwald, and I've always been hawkish on the military industrial complex and our national security and national intelligence agencies. So finding a solution. So national populism is two things. One, it is the promotion of the nation state against globalism, and populism is the class struggle between those who are, I guess, the bourgeoisie, for lack of a better word, and the working class. And when I say the bourgeoisie, I don't mean people who, you know, a guy who owns a car dealership and he may make a lot of money and have a nice house. I'm talking about the people who control institutional wealth and the vast majority of the wealth in the country. The ones who have power in how we create the economy we have. Those are people that I'm interested in discussing how the economy does and doesn't work for them versus the rest of the people. So that's basically where national populism is. And there's no direct ideology, and you know, you have to do A, B, and C to reach your conclusion D. It's okay, how do we get there? And do we do the free market? Great. If we use the government, great. If we use a mixture, fine. If you use, you know, the church, okay, whatever it has to do to tackle an issue, let's figure out the way to do to tackle an issue, which I think is a little different and neat. But it's definitely the ideology that is surging. It's kind of economic centrism mixed with more social conservatism.
I would absolutely agree that it's the ideology surging. You know, it was funny. You placed the dichotomy between, say, the working class, right, and those that own not only wealth, but I would say cultural capital as well, right? The ability to shape opinions and control institutions. And I think that the perfect economy of that is Newton Falls versus Chagrin Falls. So the hometown where I came from, worked in New York City on Wall Street for a while, which is actually very liberal, but people in Youngstown don't realize that. It's very left-wing. And they moved to Chagrin Falls. And Chagrin Falls is a town that I live in now. Very, very wealthy and affluent. Almost all the old working class Newton Falls. Newton Falls used to be a blue-collar Democratic area. Chagrin Falls was a classically Republican area. But today you drive around, Newton Falls has the Trump signs. In Chagrin Falls, they have the Biden signs, right? It's switch. So my final question before I turn it over to Michael is, what has happened in our parties? You know, we had Rich Barris on, People's underscore pundit, and he kind of was talking through this. But to people who are kind of like, what the hell is going on with American politics? None of it makes sense. Everything seems totally in flux. What is going on underneath the surface between the two great parties and this shift? How would you describe it? Is it the rise of national populism? What's going on? What's the story behind the story?
Well, it's happening on a global scale. I think, I'm sorry, I'm tweeting out to check out the link right now.
No, you're good. You're good.
So I think that it's happening on a global scale. What it is that the culturally and economically affluent class, those in the upper middle class, care enormously about, for lack of a better word, being judged, or their how they give off their appearance. They constantly wanted to be, they want to have some kind of understanding of all this wealth they've accumulated. What does it mean for the greater social good? For a large part, that doesn't filter into things like nationalism, to things like religion, things that connect and bind working class people who have less cultural institutions to help them than the upper middle class does. So they become adherents, especially their children do, to social liberalism, the need to belong to a cause, the need to belong to something. And whether that becomes, in when I was growing up, gay marriage, now it's Black Lives Matter. Before that, it was probably the anti-war movement. It's the idea of belonging to something greater than yourself. We used to have social institutions that gave you that sense of identity, whether it be marriage, a church, some sort of patriotic institution, lodges, local institutions, that kind of grounded some people in something. But also, I think the dichotomy of wealth has changed. So we have, you know, back in the earlier part of the last century, in the early 1900s and mid-1900s, wealth was kind of, wealthy people lived in areas fairly somewhat mixed. You could have a wealthy person live in an area of a non-wealthy person. Mr. Rogers, the TV star Mr. Rogers, his mother came from a wealthy family somewhere between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, I think in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, but lived among many poor people. And it was very common for people in her, I think it was Episcopalian church, to collect money at the end of the year and pay off everybody in the neighborhood's unpaid medical bills. It was a very common thing that they did, where the wealthy felt some kind of connection to the physical location that they were in and the people that they lived amongst. The Kodak family basically built Rochester or Buffalo, New York. That was not uncommon. Now, it is extremely uncommon for very high levels of wealth to live near middle or lower class levels of wealth. People like George Will, the conservative writer George Will, he lives in a neighborhood. I think the average house is like $3 or $4 million, and the average income is like $400,000 a year, and it's like 96% white. He doesn't live around any poor people. So the people who are fighting against globalism, against neoliberalism, against Marxism in a sense, they are the ones who feel the greatest effect towards the policies oftentimes being pushed in academia or by the political class. And those who are upper middle class feel like they're part of some kind of, a greater mission beyond themselves to sit there and do something. And it's not in the sense of, oh, I'm going to help stay in a community that is impoverished and do my little to help it. I'm going to move to an area that's gated away, that's removed from poverty, and just donate money to a social cause that makes me feel good. And the great things about social causes oftentimes is you can never actually solve them. So it's an endless battle of, going to dinner parties, collecting checks and giving it to some group here or there. And the problem never goes away, but it gives you some kind of satisfaction that you're doing something with your life. I think that that's a big, big part of it.
Sorry, Michael. I lied. So one issue that I wrestle with, right, because this is the new force. I think this is the rising force. This is the force behind MAGA, and this is the force that will last after MAGA, and it's this national populism. Because I think, A, they're the constituency there, B, that the times are ripe, and C, it's a refreshing ideology. I think neoconservatism is kind of stale. Libertarianism, it has had its moment. It's been found wanting. So I think this is the direction the right wing is going. But here's the problem I have with national populism, right? Is you're kind of, you're adrift on the currents and you're kind of fighting the currents at the same time. And what I mean by this is, if you read your Karl Marx, if you read your Marxism, and Marx was wrong in a lot of respects, but he's also right in other key respects. The key tendency of capitalism is to consolidation. And I'm an M&A, by the way. I'm an investment banker. So
You're part of that evil enemy. I am, right? Crushing the working class.
Yes. I used to work for Barclays Capital. So I get it. But the key force of capitalism – so the national populist critique – and there's a question here. I'm not going to blather. But the national populist critique says that really modern leftism in American politics is a force for the capitalist order. And it's a way of consolidating, reinforcing power. And if you look at, say, immigration, for example, liberal immigration policies and wanting to open the borders does nothing to help the working class. It further pushes down their bargaining power by bringing in all this competition, and it further entrenches the capitalist class, right? That's a national populist critique of left-wing immigration policies. But here's my problem. And national populists are not socialists, right? You're not communists. You still believe in a role for capitalism. You believe in private property. You want the capitalist system. You're traditionalists. You're conservatives in that. So in one hand, your national populism defends this traditional capitalist order. But on the other hand, the traditional capitalist order is going in the exact opposite direction. It's going towards consolidation. And the natural gravity of modern capitalism is towards open borders, consolidation, and further entrenching capital, et cetera. So it seems kind of a halfway strategy or halfway ideology in the sense that it's ameliorative, right? It doesn't actually solve anything.
Well, so I'll push back on you for a second. I think that we have to, I mean, we're too stuck in boomer talking points to actually have like thorough conversations in this country, but like we don't have like a real free market system. And in fact, what oftentimes we have is corporatism.
Right.
So yeah, there's a mass consolidation of power oftentimes because the regulatory state and the managerial state crush lower, smaller businesses so that there could not be any form of capitalism. All I'm saying is that things, institutions that we should use institutional powers, institutions like the Department of Justice should be crushing bankers who created the Great Recession, or should be crushing big tech, which silences conservatism. If we had a specific and simplified, free market system, and you know we were creating monopolies on our own, then that's one thing, and that's something to deal with. But in fact, oftentimes this exacerbation of wealth, this creation of the mega billionaire, the Michael Bloombergs of the world, that was not just by free market enterprise. Michael Bloomberg's wealth went from $4 billion to, I think, $25 billion over a period of 10 years. And that was during the Obama bailouts of the banks.
Right.
The state has exacerbated the creation of the uber wealthy and the mega billionaires and the American oligarchy. What I'm saying is that we should, I have no problem with someone becoming a millionaire. If you are a successful business of a construction company and you're worth $50 million, great. If you have $50 billion and you make it over the course of 20 years, that's an insane amount of wealth. And oftentimes that creation of wealth is not through market forces. It's simply through the fact that the state is there to create that wealth for you. That is my bigger problem. So I'm not sitting there and saying we should abolish capitalism or that we should punish a successful business owner, hardly. And I would like to make life easier for them to start their own businesses. But for the mega wealthy who are using the powers of the state and leveraging powers of the state to exacerbate their wealth. I mean, look what happened with the COVID coronavirus. We are
right.
Seeing the shutdown of small businesses left and right. And in its place, we are seeing, you know, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, and Michael Bloomberg become wealthier than most countries in the world. That is extremely problematic, and that just didn't happen because you can get the cheapest thing possible on Amazon.com.
So it's interesting, though, that the national populace kind of your critique is like a classically libertarian critique, right? That the reason we have these disparate
don't affiliate me with libertarians.
It's a little libertarianism, Ryan. It is. It's like because the market was corrupted and that there was regulatory capture and that enabled the vast disparities in wealth. But the national populism, and I am a national populist, by the way, so this is a friendly line of question, playing devil's advocate.
No.
But the problem with it is like Ryan wants to empower the state by restricting trade, restricting immigration, breaking up monopolies.
I'm not empowering the state. The state already has those powers. I'm not giving them additional powers. I'm saying use the power you already have to do something to help the working class. So I'm not saying let's create new powers and new entities for the state. The state has everything at its fingertips. All I'm saying is now use that power in the correct terms. Oftentimes what happens is liberals get in power and they say, hey, how do we move the football to the 1 yard line so we score a touchdown? And the right sits there and says, oh, how do we move the football to the 50 yard line? Let's have a fair fight. That is not the answer.
Totally right. Yeah.
So the answer is how do we use the institutions? Like, why is the Justice Department not they are investigating big tech, but why aren't they investigating half these other organizations? Why did only one banker in 2008 ever go to jail? And he went to jail for about 35 seconds. So, right. I mean, they've been harder on Martha Stewart than they have on half of these. On Jeff Bezos and Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg is literally trying to now use racial-based, paying off the jail sentences or the prison loans.
Black and brown felons.
Black and brown people. Only brown people. I mean, that's a race-based discrimination. But
right.
How do we use the institutions of the state to sit there and crush the people who want to destroy us? That's what I'm sitting there and saying. And how do we use the institutions of the state, the powers that they already have, to uplift the working class who have been left behind? That's my entire argument. It's not to give the state brand new powers and let them regulate everything. I don't want to do that. I want to to empower free market capitalism, especially on the local level among small businesses. But that is not happening right now, and in great part because of the power of the American oligarchs.
I guess my final question or my final point would be, the only problem with that is that the socialists would argue that the American state and the American oligarchs are intertwined, and you would agree with that, right? But to empower, the question would be who controls the state. In Ryan's perfect world, you know, obviously we don't want the oligarchs to control the state, right? Because they're using it to further themselves. If we elect busybody liberals, right, they're not really doing anything. They're just tweeting BLM while the state gets more powerful and Bezos becomes more powerful. But it seems like if we elect Republicans pass a lower 15% capital gains tax, right, and declare victory, right, mission accomplished. So who is it that we want to control the state? Because there are not enough national. Is it the workers, right? Like who is this? Well,
that's what I'm fighting against. I'm trying to. I mean, I meet with congressmen and soon to be congressmen pretty regularly, and I sit there and I bitch about the idea that you're going to uplift people through just tax cuts alone. I have an article. I think it's I'm submitting it to the editor, so I don't know if they're going to decline it, but I don't think they're going to. About the white working class families on television, on narrative television, and look at a family like Roseanne or right. King of the Hill or Malcolm in the Middle or Shameless, the Gallagher family from Shameless. When could tax cuts ever have helped those families? And the answer is not. It just can't. And you need to think outside the box. Too often, you know, conservatism in its traditional sense was supposed to be the antithesis of orthodoxy.
Right.
Orthodoxy is like libertarianism, socialism, communism, political religion. We were not supposed to be a political religion, conservatism. But it has become that because they are so welded to libertarians on the market. And it's idiotic. And I am constantly pushing people just to think outside that box. So I'm doing it little by little on a personal level, yeah, through my Twitter account, but I meet with congressmen regularly and state legislators too. And I talk to them about, like, this is the issues of your area and your state. How can you use the reins of government to sit there and actually help their life rather than sitting there and saying, we're going to do it vis-a-vis, you know, just the free market, because that's not the answer.
I have a million other questions, but I promised I'd pause to let Michael. No. I'm sorry.
I knew Dane was going to be fired up having you on, Ryan. So
yeah, okay. Sorry.
So I guess I have two questions, but I'll go with the first one because the second one's a good segue into the Tim Ryan versus Christina Hagen race. So Ryan, on your Twitter, you note that you're a Roman Catholic. I see others such as
Kenny. I had to write that because I'm Italian and Polish and I look Jewish. And like I was getting a tweet a week saying like, you fat ugly Jew, and I was like, I'm not Jewish, like call
you're
me
not fat,
fat
either.
Ugly. But like, well, I lost a little weight, but I was like, at least get the religion correct. So, but yeah, I am Roman Catholic, but that was a big thing being called. I was like, you know, being called a fat Jew, like just call me fat, it's fine. Like you don't have to get the Jewish part.
Ryan, do you believe that America is a And I'm a Roman Catholic too, but I have more of a WASPy background, so it's an internal struggle. Do you believe America is a Protestant country? I mean, like, can a Roman Catholic in America? You're always kind of an outsider, right? Because here's the real story: the WASPs in America have become left wing liberals. So if you want to say I'm an American traditionalist, the traditional ethnic group is super left wing. As a Catholic, you're an outsider.
I think that we assimilate to Protestant ethics often, even if we are Catholic. Because if you go other places in the world, American Catholics and Catholics in, let's say, Italy or Brazil don't have the same kind of mentality that we do. I think that it's more of a melding. So while our religion or our orthodoxy may be different, I do think that we assimilate into Protestant ethics as far as, you know, our mentalities go on certain things. So that's why I think, yes, it is Protestant as culturally and ethically Protestant, but you know, most Catholic majority countries don't have the best, aren't the least corrupt in the world and don't have some of the things that I think that we've inherited from the Protestant sense. And even American Catholic legislators have inherited. And I think that's a good thing. Okay. That would probably come back to bite me in the ass like in 5 years when I sit there and say something else. You know, you think we're all assimilating to be Protestants. So
So Dane mentioned how he's Catholic. Obviously, I'm Catholic as well. We graduated the same Catholic high school in Youngstown. So my question is this: you know, I see you noted why you put Catholic in your Twitter bio. Kellyanne Conway, Jack Posobiec, those different commentators or analysts, they do as well. So my question is this: have you ever run into a scenario when your political beliefs or your populist beliefs maybe contradict your faith? And I'm thinking the biggest one maybe for populists would be immigration. So I'm just curious kind of how you address that.
Yeah, but like, okay, so immigration, if the world were made up of Roman Catholics who had an orthodoxy to Rome and their allegiance was to Rome, and we were living with distributism, I would have no problem with open borders, but that's just not the world we live in at all, and it never will be. And in fact, it was Cardinal Robert Sarra who, during the migration crisis in Europe in 2017, but the migration crisis in Europe, he sat there and said, and it's a black cardinal from Africa, he sat there and said, when you rob people of their culture, of their nations, of their language, all they become are tools tools of consumption and production, and you rob them of their humanity. So our culture is so, our culture and our nation absolutely, if done correctly, it emboldens the possibility to sit there and be more fulfilling people. Otherwise, if it was just open borders, you know, the open border idea that, you know, maybe Pope Francis has is not the one that we're going to inherit. We're going to inherit Jeff Bezos' idea of open borders. And so I think that notion of, oh, we're going to have one nation of open borders is very romantic, but I don't think that it's grounded in any truth whatsoever. And some bishops and cardinals oppose it, including ones in Africa. So I don't get hung up on that. That's not, you know, to deny open borders is not to deny that, you know, Christ is the son of, is the son of God. Like that is a bigger problem that the Catholic Church has than people denying that than you know, denying open borders. It's kind of like the neoliberal version of you know, the church's orthodoxy.
So my transition question, and this will get into the Tim Ryan versus Christina Hagen race. So when I think of populism, and maybe I'm off base on this. So predating Tim Ryan was Congressman Jim Trafficant. You know, obviously, yeah, he went to jail. So
super popular.
Yeah, yeah. So he was popular in this district. I think he was Congressman Dane for probably 20 some years. But towards the end, he was pissing off people of both sides. And if you go on YouTube, he has some interesting 1 minute speeches on C-SPAN. So I guess my question is this: does populism transcend then party lines? I think it does. And I'm guessing that would probably be the idea of why Trump did well in this part of the country.
So yeah, populism. So there's a left-wing populism and a right-wing populism, and they shouldn't be confused. There is a Bernie Sanders populism and a Donald Trump populism. The difference is that on the right, they are more aligned with, I guess, the libertarian-esque corporate principles and unwielding towards them. You know, there's always a market force that could fix any social ill, like healthcare, which they have no actual fundamental answer to. And then on the left, they have a lot of, interesting ideas on how to solve a lot of social and economic problems, but they're too woke on certain issues for most people to ever align to. So yeah, I want to hear about how to make healthcare more affordable. I pay $700 a month for some of the shittiest healthcare I've ever had before. Whoa. But if that comes at the expense of calling Christopher Columbus an evil person and saying that my ancestors should have never come, every continent my ancestors ever touched, they destroyed. I'm not going to play that game. I'm not going to join that side. And that's the side. So because they are too woke on things like race, the left has kind of ceded a large portion of their labor, pro-labor working class base that has moved to the right, because maybe they're not in love with the idea of finding market forces to solve every problem, but they're definitely not okay with being told that their ancestors were all evil patriarchs who spent their lives dreaming of how to destroy every other people on the planet.
Let me ask a quick question, though. So let me play devil's advocate, okay? And let me ask, well, what's wrong with wokeism? Like, okay, Ryan, you care about the working class. You care about working people. You care about the people of Youngstown, right? Why not accept a little bit of woke politics? We'll tear down the Christopher Columbus statue. And in return, we're going to give the people of Youngstown health care and free health care through a public option and or Medicare for all, whatever it may be. And we're going to give them a $15 an hour minimum wage. And we're going to give them increased unionization and pro-union people on the National Labor Relations Board. So, you know, why not take a little wokeism? What's the danger in that? This is
wokeism is like cyanide. There's not a little bit of cyanide. You're either in or you're out. Like, you're either dead or you're not dead. And wokeism sits there and prescribes that you have to accept things like critical race theory. You have to accept things that your child has to believe that they are inherently born racist. Wokeism is a religion. It is. They have their own holidays, like, you know, Juneteenth. They have their own sacraments, like the washing of the feet of random black people. And also, I mean, there was a school in California that they had a rule where if you had a certain percentage of white students, of non-white students, rather, you got all this extra money. Well, one of the neighborhoods gentrified and the white population went from like 10% to 35%. And they stripped the school of all this special funding. Now, 65% of the school are still mostly Hispanic, poor, but they got nothing because they were even associated being close to white people. They view it as a disease. I'm sorry, I wouldn't accept that if we had that policy towards blacks or Hispanics or Asians or anybody. I'm not going to accept it towards white people either. And this dichotomy of race is very, very, very problematic, especially because, you know, they're cheering on the day where whites are minority. And it's not to sit there and say we're going to be, you know, we're going to have a multiracial Woodstock. It's because they're selling the politics of revenge. It's very dangerous and it's very evil what they're doing. It really is insidious and it should be called that. And we should be using, as Trump did. I mean, this is probably one of the best things that Trump did. And Trump ended critical race theory for contracts. Certain colleges had to end the critical race theory teaching. Businesses had to end it. That was one of the best things he did. That's what I'm talking about. Using the institutions and power of the institutions to sit there and, you know, fight the cultural battle, fight the change.
So I want to move on to the big race, or at least I think it's big. So Tim Ryan versus Christina Hagan. And it's important to note this fact, and somebody had sent this to me before the show. So Tim Ryan, sometime, early 19, Dane, decides he wants to run for president. And
early.
Early 19. Dane, where did Tim Ryan go to launch his presidency?
And oh,
this, to
I
me,
was
shows
there.
Why he's out of
Ryan,
touch
I was there
different.
For the kickoff. The kickoff was in downtown Youngstown, but he announced it on The View. The View, like the dumbest place on the planet. You know, if you're Tim Ryan, you're shtick, right? Every politician has a shtick, and Tim Ryan's shtick is being I speak for the working class and not, you know, I'm a moderate Democrat.
He's a dime store Sherrod Brown.
Yeah, he's a right. You can't afford shit. That's brilliant, right?
If you can't afford Sherrod Brown, you got Tim Ryan.
You can't, yeah, you go to Tim Ryan, right? Like your credit card's maxed out. You go to Tim Ryan, you get 10 cents on the dollar. And then he announces on The View. We're like, nobody, I'm sorry, you can't be an intelligent person and watch The View. I think those are mutually excludable positions. And that shouldn't be a controversial statement.
You have to look at the audience of The View. The audience is majority women, which he is not doesn't have a base to, and it's a lot of non-white women, which are the base of the Democratic Party. So, I mean, from a political calculating standpoint, that seems fine to announce on The View because you're going to directly speak to a very large audience of non-white women, which are the base of the Democratic Party. The reason that Michael Bloomberg was surging in the polls early on was because he put $500 million, not just towards advertisement, but especially daytime TV advertisement, which are a huge portion of, I think it's a majority non-white women. If it's not majority, it's very close to
it. I had no idea. I would never have thought that.
Daytime TV is a very large non-white female audience, the base of the Democratic Party, and that's why you speak to that audience, especially if you're running. That's why you put a lot of advertising money in that market. So it made complete sense from a political calculating standpoint. Is it like going to be, or are you going to be asked, but you know, oh, which version of feminism do you believe in? Camille Paglia's second wave feminism, or, you know, Jessica Venti's third wave feminism? You're not going to have that kind of conversation, but no. You know, they'll ask you what kind of suits you're wearing or something. And as long as you come up likable, it might get you a couple percentage points in the polls.
I didn't know there was such a big non-white audience. I assumed that it was like white soccer moms.
No.
Watching The View. That's fascinating. Okay. So there was some logic there. It didn't work. Oh, yeah. It blew up spectacularly in his face, but there was some logic there.
Yeah. It makes complete sense from the Democrat primary standpoint. There's a book called Ladies Who Punch about The View. It's a great book, actually. It's written really, really well. And highly recommend the audio version if you just want to have something to listen to on the drive, because it's really entertaining. And if you know, like, the cast of characters. But they break down the demographics of the show and how heavy the non-white audience is on the show. Same thing, by the way, with The Apprentice. Part of the reason that Trump, I think, had certain advantages earlier on with non-white audiences is because The Apprentice, back when it started — that's my dog in the background ripping up his bed for some reason — The View is one of the few shows that had non-white people, back when it was before pre-celebrity Apprentice, when it was just a regular Apprentice, where it had non-white people in a role as an entrepreneur, not necessarily as a villain. And so it had a tremendously high non-white audience. And I think it dipped significantly when he came out with the Obama birther thing, but he carried a large portion of that. And it might be why he did his couple points better with certain sectors of the non-white voters.
Huh.
Yeah.
That is interesting. I did not realize that about The View. So I want to provide some context for this race. So Tim Ryan's been the congressman here since 2002. Obviously, the district changed between 2010 and 2012 when the districts were redrawn, but he's been congressman for 18 years. And what's important to note is, so Christina Hagan had a press release about her third quarter fundraising, and she net close to $500,000, which is huge. And I think it's a critical point, because I went back to 2002, and all of Tim Ryan's competition over all those years raised a whopping $632,000. So in one quarter for Christina Hagan to raise that, I think is impressive. I think the timing of President Trump's endorsement was right at the start of July. I could be wrong on that, so I'm guessing that has something to do with it. But it's impressive nonetheless, and I think she even noted that at the end of Q3, she actually has more cash on hand than Tim Ryan.
Which is
huge. And we've been covering this race quite a bit over the last, what, probably seven, eight episodes, Dane. And the biggest thing that kind of hit home to us is all of a sudden Tim Ryan's launching a lot of TV ads against Christina Hagan, which is sort of surprising. There's you.
Did he do that last time?
No, definitely not. No, this is a big deal. No, he's never had an ad ever.
Never. Maybe in 2002 when he first was coming out, because it was a redrawn district against, I think, Ann Wilmer Benjamin, who may or may not have been a congressman back in the day. That was it. There was like a vote Tim Ryan. He had a little jingle and all that. So, you know, President Trump's endorsed her. You've tweeted about her. There's been some other conservatives on Twitter who have tweeted about her. She's raising this money. From the surface, without knowing too much, it seems like this is going to be a tight race. So what can you share with us, and is it?
So Christina, as a full disclosure, I worked on Christina's 2018 race. I've known her for about 4 or 5 years now, and I did her primary this time around. Sorry, my dog is now in my lap, so if you see him pop up, that's just to keep him quiet. I was on her race this time, in the primary, not in the general. And she has been fundraising, you know, really, really well. She's a very effective and very energetic legislator, former legislator and candidate. And I think that her appeal is especially, strong because, she's not from wealth. She's from a working class background. She speaks in a language that people understand, and she's not trying to, I guess, be something bigger than what she is. She is very much attached to her area where she's from. This is not so that she can, you know, go to Washington and get a home in Boca and just retire and live on the beach like, you know, John Boehner or something. I think that that definitely gives her a certain element of authenticity, and that's something that Christina has in her advantage. But also because the district is radically changing. This is a district that a Republican could have never won, and that Trump has definitely closed the gap significantly in 2016. And some polls that I've heard internally show him up in the district this time. And I think Tim Ryan is worried about that, is about this changing white working class that is, that's the district, that's changing significantly. And it's, I think the 13th of Ohio, if I'm not mistaken, is one of the poorest districts in this country. And it has seen the deterioration of wealth and social standing over the course of people's lifetimes. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that even as late as the early 2000s, where you had certain jobs there. And in the last couple of years, you saw Lordstown close, you saw GM close, there was something else where people lost their
Northside Hospital.
Youngstown Vindicator.
Yeah. People, I mean, this is not ancient history. And Tim Ryan's been there for 18 years, sitting there and saying, I'm the fighter for the working class. I'm the working class champion. Well, life for the working class ain't getting any better. And in your 18 years, you got 3 bills signed, and 2 of them were post office renamings. I looked this up. I think I'm pretty sure it was 3 bills.
Really?
Signed. Yeah, and 2 were post office renamings. in the 2008 to 2010 year, Congress, that those 2 years that the Democrats controlled everything, Tim Ryan didn't get a single one of his bills sponsored to pass Congress. And they controlled, there was no one stopping it. There was no Republican voice. Nothing could be done. He had all the power in the world, and he got nothing done. And you can only do that song and dance for so long and never get results. And I think that now, where the Republican Party is not the party of Mitt Romney anymore, people who would never have voted for a Republican are now saying, well, Democrats aren't doing their business on jobs. Plus, we're getting the woke nonsense. Republicans are not as scary as they once were. They're not as much the party of the managerial class, and they're not selling me wokeism. So at least I could fight on the culture wars. And I think that that is definitely giving people a second glance at someone like Christina. Christina also is a mom. She's young. I think she's 31 or something like that. 30.
Yeah, I think she's around our age. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think what's important to note. So just playing devil's advocate, I think Tim Ryan's argument is he has a seat on the Appropriations Committee. So his argument is he's brought back, I don't know if it's $2.4 or $4.2 billion to the district. I'd fire back at that as, and so far as saying, where are the jobs? There's been, obviously he's brought money back, and that's fine and dandy.
It brings money back to the local military bases and the schools. No one's going to be defunding the schools or the military bases. But, when Trump sat there and went to Congress 25 times to try to close the carried interest loophole that Wall Street happened, Tim Ryan didn't do shit to try to pass it. He didn't sit there and collect a cohort of Democrats saying, hey, let's work with the president on this one, get it in, committee and sit there and get it passed. And we'll, at least serve it to Wall Street bankers this way. The man can't get anything accomplished. So you can only say for so long, oh, I'm going to sit there and give this thing or that thing. There's nothing there. And I think that that is, I think that people are tired of that rhetoric over and over and over and over again. And Tim Ryan's also very easily hateable.
Yes. Ryan, I love you. Yes.
No, he's very easily hateable. His presidential any favors. I mean, the only 2 times he ever made news is when he had that fight with Bernie Sanders, where he said to Bernie, Bernie said, I wrote the damn bill. And then he had that fight with Tulsi Gabbard, where he didn't know the difference between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. That sunk his ship pretty quickly.
He's not a very bright man. I mean, to be completely
honest. I mean, you look at them, there's not a lot going on.
He's kind of dopey.
You could see the one gerbil that's still alive moving the wheel. And that's it. So that's problematic for sure. And I think that people have just, I think that there's a genuine dislike on a certain level for him. From, and by the way, I don't live there. I've been to Northeast Ohio quite a bit. Just seeing people comment on Facebook, people comment on everything. And yeah, going to someone's high school graduation or grammar school graduation and giving money to the military base is fine. But when everyone's losing their jobs, you have a significant brain drain. You know, I've been to parts of Northeast Ohio, and I'm not shitting on you guys whatsoever, but it looks like we lost the war. I mean, it's
true. Yeah.
It's decrepit. It's, and I've been to other cities like that where it's an embarrassment. Why do we have cities in America like this? So don't sit there and say I'm the working class people when everyone's losing their jobs and there's, you know, holes in the streets that you could put mattresses in. And that is real. I mean, that there was a United States Senator from New York for a very long time named Alphonse D'Amato. And his big thing was, his main constituent thing was that he could get he could fill potholes in the highways and the local streets. This man spent billions of dollars getting potholes fixed. He wasn't a great legislator. He was a pretty liberal Republican, but he made people happy for most of his career because at least their quality of life was decent, even if everything else was going wrong. Tim Ryan hasn't even delivered on that. And he keeps saying, oh, it's what I control, I've delivered on. Okay, give me a freaking break. There's a reason that for an incumbent Democrat in a year, Democrats are killing money. They're making more money than ever before. Tim Ryan can't raise shit. And I think he raised like, what, $600,000, while Kristina raised $500,000, and he's got less cash on hand. He's probably also, I don't know this for a fact, so this is alleged, but he probably also has a bunch of, you know, high expensive political consultants, you know, just soaking his campaign for every penny it's worth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Tim Ryan for president campaign made some people rich, and little else. That was all it did. He was also really weak on tariffs too. He had this kind of shtick like 10 years ago. He was like, oh, I got to be tough on China. And then Trump took the strongest action against China in my lifetime, right, by imposing the China tariffs. And Tim Ryan was just like, oh, I'm for them, but I'm actually against them. But I'm for tariffs, but we got to do it in the polite way. And it was just a really muddled.
Yeah. And then he bashed Joe Biden while Joe Biden was running for president, because Joe Biden said China is not our competition. Tim Ryan's retarded. And like, he could actually be able to win over Trump people, Trump voters. They could vote, you know, Trump Ryan, if he had some semblance of a coherent ideology. But he can't deliver on shit because he cares more about being a national celebrity than he does being, and he can't be a national celebrity either. I mean, no one's going to say, like, put that poster on my wall. So
he was somewhat attractive when he was younger, like in a weird kind of rugged way, I guess. I don't know, but like, for a politician, right, politician standards are lower than everybody else's standards.
The guy looks like Gumby, for crying out loud.
I mean, now he does. Yeah. Now he just went downhill. Like, that
he was made out of Play-Doh.
Yeah, it's not good. The alcohol's not been kind to him. but that's another issue, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Ryan, I have one point on Tim Ryan. Michael, I don't mean to cut you off.
I know we only have a few more minutes. Go ahead.
My parents would always say that Tim Ryan's going to lose. Tim Ryan's going to lose. Nobody likes him, right? And every year or every 2 years, they'd be like, yeah, you guys are delusional, right? I know you're Republicans and boomers, but he gets the votes. However, I have to say, Ryan, driving throughout the district, okay, and I don't live in the district. I live in David Joyce's district, who's a Republican congressman.
I know.
But when going to see my parents, I drive through the district and tons of Hagan signs. So here's an on the ground report or some insider intel for you, Ryan. You can report back to your network. Tons of Hagan signs all over the place. And I was in Girard, Ohio, which is a key blue area, and I saw tons of Hagan signs. It shocked me. It absolutely shocked me.
I'm not super surprised that as the electorate's changing. Also, Kristina, because of her past time as the state legislator, I think she doesn't scare. She does two things. One, because she's a young person and a woman, she excites older boomers who hate Trump.
Yeah.
They always want to have a girl on their side, and they always want to have a young person on their side. And secondly, her rhetoric, she doesn't speak like me. She's not going to sit there and tell Tim Ryan that he looks like shit. Like, she's not going to say things that I would say.
No.
So the people who are horrified by Trump's demeanor, but like him on policies, would not be horrified on Kristina's demeanor. And I think that that's very helpful in certain, you know, suburban districts, suburban areas that, that Republicans are having a lot of tough times in this election cycle.
So speaking, go ahead, Dane.
No, I don't want to cut you off, Michael. You go ahead.
All right, I just wanted to mention, so in the chat, Gino DeFabio is in there. So and Ryan, just so you know, Gino was, I think, featured in the RNC this year. He's been on Fox News quite a few times, and Trump, I think him and Trump have maybe some sort of relationship. Anyways, he's a big advocate for Christine Hagan, and he noted something in on Facebook. He says Tim's comfort level is what will be his downfall. He's aligned with the radical left. But I think the most important thing here, and I think it's a winning point for Christina, there's no way he writes that letter to Barr about police in the country as he did without worry of repercussions.
And he was the most well-known person on that freaking letter. I know. How do you say, oh, you know, we got to be an advocate to first responders, and they need emergency pay, and they need this, and I'm fighting for the public sector union. Also, let's defund one of the biggest public sector unions because they're all effing racist. I mean, this man, the IQ is, you know, under 100 for sure. So and the thing is about police officers, and I think this is going to hurt some Democrats who are running for office. Everyone knows a cop. Everyone knows a teacher. Everyone knows. That was the problem with Republicans forever, attacking the teachers unions. Everyone knows a teacher. So they come up looking like they're attacking the teachers. This time, the Democrats are literally attacking, you know, physical police officers, not just the institution of policing. That, by the way, is one of the biggest ladders people can use to climb economically to protect themselves and to advance themselves into the middle class.
Yeah, a lot of minorities, Black and Hispanic men and women.
Youngstown's probably close to minority-majority police department.
I think so. I would say it's at least 50-50, if not minority-majority. Yeah. Ryan, here's my question for you, my final question. And thank you for being patient with me as I ask this.
No problem. We have a few more minutes.
You're a very plugged-in individual, right? You've got connections.
Allegedly.
Deep. Within all sorts of halls of power, right? And we're going to be your connection.
I'm a whore, yeah.
So Northeast Ohio, right? So if you ever need intel in Northeast Ohio, contact us. We'll tell you who's going to win the state. But you're plugged in to the corridors of power. You're also friends with Ann Coulter, which is something I would love to talk to you about, but neither here nor there. Are we screwed this election?
Oh God, this is a question I get all the time. Are we screwed?
Can you just give me something, even if you completely make it up, that will be like, Dane, the internal show that it's not as bad as it looks, hold on to faith, or are we completely, totally fucked? Just tell me the truth, or lie to me.
Which one do you want, lie to you or tell you the truth?
Oh God, I don't know, Ryan, you pick.
Okay, the lie is, yeah, California and New York are within reach. The truth is, the truth is that, yes, the polling is horrible. I mean, everyone can look at the numbers in the poll, and the polling is absolutely terrible. But I will say I've seen some of the polling, and I do think that they're undercounting the rural vote pretty big. And I will say that, look, if Trump's losing independents and seniors by 30 points in some of the polls show, it doesn't matter. It is over. Yeah. But I have a very hard time looking at a group of people he won by 20 points last time or 10 points last time and seeing him lose by 30 points this time. I just have a hard time really believing that there's that many people who are switching over to vote for Joe Biden. I will say in the polls, they show one good thing on our side, which is enthusiasm is definitely on our side, and turnout is what really matters. And secondly, the Democrats don't have a ground game at all. I mean,
does it matter?
Yeah, of course. I mean, have you seen the voter registration numbers?
But here's what I wrestle with, right? Is that just fake news that, like, we're down so much that we got to cling on to something? We have these voter registration numbers.
No, it's not.
Democrat for years has always voted Republican for the last 30 years, and they're just finally updating their ID, and it's not a net vote.
Yeah, it's not just all that, though. It's not just – all of these voters are not just – if that was the truth – you would see a surge of people in the suburbs of Philadelphia becoming a Democrat and a surge of people in the center of Pennsylvania becoming Republican. That's not what's happening. You're seeing high levels of Republican registration universal across, including in cities like Pittsburgh. You're seeing high levels of voter registration for Republicans. A lot of these are new voters. Remember, the biggest vote in this country is non-voters. There are 40 As of 2016, there were 42 million or 44 million non-college educated white Americans who were not even registered to vote. So that, and I told, and I will tell you something I've never said out loud to anybody on a podcast. So in 2017, I wrote a long, long, long letter to Brad Parscale, I think 11 pages, detailing, if you get 10% of non-registered voters in these areas, in these states, here are the counties, you could tell Hillary Clinton supporters to kick dust for the next 4 years. You have it in the bag. Don't go chasing Latinos in New Mexico. Just focus on these non-college educated white voters. There's more than enough of them. And then anything after that, any percentage increase of the black vote or the Latino vote or anyone else is just icing on the cake. Somewhere in the last couple of months, maybe since Brad descended the campaign or even before then, the Republican, the RNC especially, has been moving specifically on voter registration. And it has also helped that the Republicans have been still knocking on doors and going to doors, and Democrats haven't. Democrats are beating us right now in mail-in ballots, but in a lot of these states where Republicans suffered, I think in North Carolina, they suffered like a 400,000 voter deficit, and now it's 200,000. And those aren't all, you know, 75-year-olds finally becoming Republican. A lot of those are new voters who have just never registered to vote ever. If that happens and we pick up those voters and Trump maintains most of his base from the last year, generally, like, Trump loses like about 7-8% and he picks up a 5-6% of Hillary voters, and there's more Hillary voters than there are Trump voters, so it basically evens out. But if Trump picks up those new voters, then I think he has a chance of winning for real. I would definitely rather be Joe Biden right now, as far as where the money goes and as far as where everything goes, but don't undercount what Trump has. It is not insignificant, and it is not. And the fact that all these things are happening, these car parades, that was the one just happened in Ohio today. These boat parties, there was 30,000 cars in Miami for a Trump rally. They're happening on their own. Like a campaign, and I actually called a campaign person and screamed at them and said, "Why the F aren't you at these boat parties registering people to vote?" And they said, "We don't even know where they're popping up. They're just showing up, and they're just happening all over the country."
Which is remarkable.
That level of excitement is something you can't hide, and you can't just create. No one is doing that for Joe Biden. They are doing it for BLM. And that's my big fear, is that these BLM people are going to just be the voting bloc of the Democratic Party. So I don't know. I worry, and I'm hesitant about Trump's chances. But if you want a silver lining, and it's a big piece of silver lining because it's real hard data. Just forget polls for a second. The two pieces of real hard data are early mail-in ballots, which heavily favor Democrats, and new voter registrations, and that heavily favors Republicans, and in important states that heavily favors Republicans. So that being said, you go into it, and whoever turns out their people matters. And, you know, I think that Trump people will turn out. The question is, are we going to have a historic, unprecedented turnout? Are we going to have 100 million people turn out? Are we going to have, or 100 million people per candidate rather turn out, 200 million people total? Are we going to have, lower turnout because of COVID? I don't know the answer to that. I think that certain places will determine the whole election. We'll find out very quickly. And so, for example, when I say for very, very quickly, in Ohio, you will look at towns with large populations of Midwestern retirees, and how they are voting will tell you how the Midwest is voting that night. Things like that will very quickly tell us what the election is going to.
So again, thank you so much, Ryan. I want to encourage everybody, please go sign up for Ryan's weekly newsletter. I signed up, I think, a couple months ago. I enjoy it every week. Get his book, They're Not Listening, How the Elites Created the National Populist Revolution, and obviously follow him on Twitter. Dane had plenty of good things to say about him at the start of the episode. Ryan, thank you so much. Big debate tomorrow night between Christina Hagen and Tim Ryan, 7 o'clock on WFMJ here in Youngstown, the NBC affiliate, and it'll be broadcast and streamed on the internet as well. So Ryan, we really appreciate the time tonight, and best wishes to you. And if you need anything from us, any intel or anything like that, let us know.
You don't have a Twitter, but Michael, yeah. I just followed you, Michael. So
yes,
just,
thank you.
So just DM me or ask me a question or whatnot. And this is fun.
Appreciate it.
All right.
All right. Take care, Ryan.
Thank you, sir. It's been an honor. That was awesome. Are we going to keep doing an episode, Michael?
Oh, I guess maybe if you have any final thoughts.
I'm sorry I asked all the questions.
No. Really especially excited. That stuff is not really my big thing about populism. So I learned quite a bit, and hopefully the people coming in, because I just come at it from the perspective of I was a conservative and I'm Democrat, Republican, polls, data. That's my knowledge. This is more you, Dane. So I knew you would like that aspect of the interview.
Yeah. No, he's Ryan. And is it Gerdusky?
Gerdusky.
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 Gerdusky. Gerdusky. Ryan Gerdusky. Excellent guy to follow. I've been following him for the last 4 years. As I said before, I don't know why I started following him, but I did. And I every day, literally every day, I check his Twitter feed because he's got such good analysis. And I got to finally meet the man in the flesh. So this is the podcast that makes all your dreams come true, right? I don't know. He's a really, really smart guy. One thing that it comes off across from talking to him is that, you know, there's politics and then there are campaigns. And the campaigns are kind of the mechanics behind politics. And Ryan's got a really mature, deep understanding of campaigns, right? And I think he feels something that Hagan can win. And or else he wouldn't be pushing her like he is.
Yeah. No, I agree. I don't think he'd be spending this kind of money when, you know, could perhaps go elsewhere if this wasn't a race. So I give him credit. I don't think he's overlooking the fact that he's in trouble. I just hope that he realizes there's a reason why he's in trouble. As the district continues to move more to the middle and he aligns more with his party and leadership, which is moving more and more to the left. But I think the biggest key is going to be that police issue and, yes, and law enforcement. I think that's we talked about this 2, 3, 4 episodes ago. It's a critical issue for Christina Hagan if she runs on it, which I think she has been from seeing her Facebook. It's critical. Those letters that the police chief of Youngstown and Struthers, both cities run by Democrat mayors, that's huge. And he had some interesting insight there about the internals thinking maybe Trump could even win. And remember, folks, he only lost his district by 7 points in 2016. And when you hear pollster Rich Bears talk on his show about Erie County and in Pennsylvania and some other parts of Western PA not shifting at all, maybe even going up a little bit more for Trump, that's gonna hit home here in the Mahoning Valley as well. So it's possible, and I'm encouraged, and I think tomorrow's debate is going to be important, and we'll see how Christina does.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited. Populism, it's the way of the future, man. Actually, I don't think populism is necessarily its own ideology. I think it's like a true understanding of conservatism. I'm a big fan of zoning laws as well, by the way. That's something Ryan mentioned. Zoning laws are what separates us from the animals, right? We need zoning. So, sorry, that was just a random aside. Should we get to the sponsor of today's episode?
Yeah, well, while you think of the sponsor, I just want to encourage people, because this was obviously our biggest audience yet. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app. We have all our podcasts. Obviously, this is episode 21. There's a lot of good insight in there, especially that episode 2 episodes ago with Rich Barris. He was great. Really loved his awesome stuff. Too. We have had a lot of comments in the chat tonight. I haven't had a chance to get to them all, so I really appreciate everybody commenting. Some of them are on Facebook, Dane. Some are on YouTube, and a lot have been actually coming in from Twitter on Periscope. So like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to us. We really appreciate Ryan coming on, helping these two nobodies from Northeast Ohio. But again, I think he did want to talk about this congressional race between Tim Ryan and Christina Hagan, because again, this is important. Nobody nationally, no prognosticator, nobody who looks at congressional races, nobody is talking about this race. And there's something here. There's something happening.
Yeah.
And at least we are talking about it. There's something to be said when there's 10,000. She's distributed over 10,000 signs, and this was a few months ago. There's something to be said that she raised $500,000 in a district that hasn't gone Democrat in how long? Right. And prior to Tim Ryan releasing his report, he never raised $500,000 in any quarter ever. And so this is really – it's remarkable, and something's happening, and I hope it's enough for Christina to get over the finish line. I think it would be great. But ultimately, and we've talked about this a lot on our podcast, this district we think is going to be one of the ones that's going to get the boot due to the census of 2020. And I think whether it's this election or the next one, Tim Ryan's going to have a tough sledding ahead for him, whether he wins this one or if he's in a new district in 2022.
I think for somebody like Christina Hagen, no matter what happens, she's a winner. She's built her profile. Even if she loses, she's gone toe to toe with Tim, and it's going to be tight. Right. Tim may win this battle, but he may ultimately lose the war. The district gets redistricted out. Tim's problem was he's just not that smart, and he the world's changing, and he doesn't know how to change with it. He was able to catch fire once, but it's hard to do it again. And it's kind of a tragic story. So I guess the lesson here of today's episode is, if you are a young wannabe politico wanting to go into politics, be more like Christina Hagen. You know, be pure, be true to the district, be true to your class. Don't be a Tim Ryan. You know, don't win and get doughy and soft and try to date the Speaker of the House's daughter so that you can get ahead in your political career and announce on The View and go nowhere, right? Don't do that. Be like Christina Hagen. So there you go. Deep thoughts with Dane.
And I do want to mention, this was give credit to Gino. And those, we talked about grassroots, like the boat parades and this big honk for Trump today in Mahoning County. And this was actually kind of gone viral on our Twitter feed, 6,000 views, Dane, on that video. My wife, Ashley, who did a great job filming that for me, because obviously I wouldn't want to get in an accident, she filmed it. But it's a big day on our Twitter account and all our social media. So again, we're catching on at the right time. And I'm trying to think, Gino, we will get you on, because I want to have a recap show to talk a little bit about this debate. And I know you're going to be watching, and I know you talk with Christina quite frequently. So I do want to have Gino on. And there are a couple others we still need to get on before Election Day. But again, we want to thank everybody for tuning in. Who is our sponsor tonight, Dane?
Oh, Ruffles Potato Chips. Ruffles Potato Chips is the sponsor of the MV Red Podcast. For when you want to be obese, but you want to do it with a certain je ne sais quoi, right? I'm going to murder the French because I never took French in high school. You know, you're like, I want to be an overweight individual by eating tons of potato chips, but I want to do it my way, right? Get some Ruffles potato chips, because they're just like regular potato chips, but they taste a million times better because they add the Ruffles. The Ruffles, it adds flavor. So Ruffles Potato Chips, the sponsor of the MV Red Podcast. The people that created Ruffles Potato Chips, huge Republicans. I completely made that up, but it's true.
So I do want to mention, so we've had, 21 episodes, and we've somehow been able to land Rich Barris, who's the pollster extraordinaire who actually called 2016 for Trump, and Ryan Gerdusky. But I do want to mention, so Ryan, or Rich Barris, is actively, I think he just actually wrapped up a poll of Pennsylvania, and he will be discussing on a show tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. on YouTube. What are the odds with Robert Barnes? I encourage people to tune into that. He's been doing this. I don't know, Dane, if you've watched any of his shows. He's doing kind of like a crowdfunding thing of polling different states. He just pulled Florida. He's currently doing Pennsylvania, and he's going to do Arizona next. But people just are contributing on PayPal or Venmo, and he raised like over $5,000 for Florida and Pennsylvania, and he was able to apply some towards Arizona. So it's something fascinating to watch. So if people have ideas of certain states you want polled, he's open ears for all of that. So definitely tune in to him. And any final thoughts, Dane?
No, I have no final thoughts. I don't like to think. It's not good. I just like to make podcasts. I can't believe we made 21 episodes of this show and that people would actually watch this. You know, it's an amazing world out there. God is truly great.
Yes. And we didn't even have a chance, and we'll maybe at one point have a chance to talk about the VP debate and what the heck's going on in that crazy presidential race. So, but nonetheless, we'll cap it off with this. Again, thank you, everybody. Please subscribe on our podcast. That's been kind of going viral quite a bit as well on any podcast app, and especially on social media. And join us, which for our next episode, whenever that'll be, maybe it's later this week or next week, we'll figure it out, but we'll be sure to tweet that out. So again, thank you, everybody. Hope you all have a great evening. Take care.
Bye.